learned that we are to rehearse what we are reminded of through God's revelation. That was the fact that God is a speaking God reminds us that when He speaks, it is essential for us to remind ourselves of those truths and then to rehearse them. And that rehearsing, we learned, is both the speaking, reminding ourselves through saying these things over and over, but then ultimately enacting them in our lives and living them out. Then last week, in verses 15 to 24, we saw that God is unique and He is jealous. We went all the way back to Genesis chapter 1. We were reminded of God's creation. We went back to days 4, 5, and 6 of the creation week, and we saw that God is so unique that nothing in His creation can appropriately represent Him. That man is not supposed to put any image to represent God. And so we saw that a true knowledge of God is radically to affect both my identity, who I am, and then what I do, how I live my life. So then this week, we're going to learn about two more characteristics of God and how those are to help us be guarded in our walk with Him. So we'll look at verses 25 to 40 today. And the two ideas, the two characteristics of God that we will learn about are the fact that He is compassionate and covenant-keeping. And so, as we begin to read these verses, I want you, by the end of today, to walk out of here knowing that God demonstrates His exclusivity, that He is alone as God. We saw that last week. We're going to be reminded of it this week. And so, in light of that, we must demonstrate our obedience. You know, Moses is hammering this point that in light of who God is, it necessitates our obedient response to His character. And so with that, let's jump into this first characteristic of God, that Yahweh is compassionate. Yahweh is compassionate, and we'll see this in verses 25 and following. Now, I'm just going to say up front, as I read these first number of verses, you're going to wonder how I got this main idea out of these verses, because it doesn't seem that the theme is God's compassion. It's actually going to seem like the theme is much more about Israel's problems. But if you would, read down with me as we look at verse 25. So Deuteronomy 4, 25. Moses says, "When you become the father of children and children's children and have remained long in the land, and you act corruptly and make an idol in the form of anything and do that which is evil in the sight of the Lord your God, so as to provoke Him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that you will surely perish quickly from the land which you are going over to the Jordan, over the Jordan to possess it. You shall not live long on it, but will utterly be destroyed." First thing I want you to see this morning about God's compassion is that God's compassion is displayed against the background of rebellion. Now, we're going to find that these things that we talk about Israel here are not just true for Israel. We're going to find them to be true of God's people today as well. But the first thing is this, that God's compassion is displayed against the background of rebellion. Look down again at verse 25. He sets the scene in their minds of their future in the land. Specifically, now their children have had children and they have lived a long life in this land. And so we would expect that this is going to be a quaint and beautiful picture of God's blessing. But instead, the next words are jarring. Things are about to change because He says, "You act corruptly." How would Israel act corruptly? Obviously, it's a negative thing, but what is it that Moses is envisioning after they've dwelled long in the land and God is seemingly blessing them? They have grandchildren now. What is it that they would do to act corruptly? Well, it's the very thing that Moses warned them about last week that we saw. What are they going to do? They are going to make an idol in the form of anything. You remember last week we went through those the days of the creation week, and God is in essence walking through those days and saying, "Don't worship the sun, moon, and stars. Don't make anything that looks like an animal. Don't make anything that looks like a fish. Don't make anything that even looks like a human. Do not worship me with any idol." And Israel will do that very thing. Acting corruptly is linked to idolatry. This is consistent all throughout Deuteronomy. When Israel acts corruptly, it's focusing on their worship. Let me give you a few examples. This is chapter 9 and verse 12. "The Lord said to me, 'Arise, go down from here quickly, because your people, whom you've brought up out of Egypt, have behaved corruptly. They have quickly turned aside from the way that I commanded them. They have made a cast metal image for themselves. Same in chapter 31 and chapter 32. Israel corrupts themselves when they forsake the worship of God alone. Now, the next words are really important because it describes how Yahweh thinks and responds to this type of corrupt activity. He says, "You do that which is evil in the sight of the Lord so as to provoke him to anger." Makes it clear a couple things. How God sees this action. Very clearly, he sees this action as evil. And then, how does he respond to it? Well, he responds to it as with anger. First of all, I want you to see that God sees idolatry, any type of idolatry, as evil. And I want to just expand this out really quickly as an application. We know when we talk about idolatry, we've talked about this before, it's not just for us today, having something that we're bowing down to. It's so easy for us to put anything in the place of God. And so as we think about this, we want to think about anything that we might exalt to a level of worship, exalt to a level of even the place that only God should have with our affections, with our desires, with our pursuits. So, whenever that happens, whether with Israel in this case, fashioning idols, or whether in our case, as Calvin says, we fashion those idols in our hearts, God sees that as evil. Now, I want to say one other thing about our world today, because our world needs to hear this. Our world wants to have these big gray areas of life. We don't like the good and evil language. We can play around with morality, we can change moral language, and sometimes we can seek to just erase morality altogether and just say that it's preferences. But that does not mean that there is no longer good and evil in God's sight. God is always looking throughout this world at good and at evil. God is the definer of what is good and evil. Good is that which reflects God's character and goodness, and evil is that which perverts and distorts God's character and goodness. And so God is saying this: whenever you do something that perverts the picture of who I am as my image bearer in this world, anytime you do that, it is evil. So whenever that happens, we find that God responds with anger. Again, our world so often gets this wrong. We want to think about God as never truly getting angry, never having a problem with us. But whether people think that's because God won't get angry or can't get angry, for one reason or another, our world wants to say that God doesn't ever get angry with our sin. But what we find here is that God responds emotionally. God's presented as responding emotionally to corruption, to idolatry. He hates it. God sees their idolatry as evil and responds emotionally to it with anger. Now look at verse 26. This is really interesting. It says, "I call heaven and earth to witness against you today." God calls witnesses to testify against Israel and their corruption. This is significant for a couple of reasons. First of all, this is a common practice of the day. We've talked, especially early on in our series, that all of Deuteronomy is structured like a covenant document that you would have found in a variety of cultures in the ancient Near East. This is very clearly a covenant relationship that's being established between God and his people. And that being the case, this is exactly what we would find in other covenant documents like this, except for one thing. Usually, instead, at this point of finding that whoever the king is, instead of calling heaven and earth to witness, usually in the covenant documents, you're going to find that they're calling other deities and gods to witness. So, though this is usually the place where other nations would invoke other deities, the question is, what is the significance then of God replacing other deities with heaven and earth? Obviously, some would want to say, oh, that's showing polytheism, but actually, God is subverting polytheism here. What he's doing is he's using the common convention of the day while subverting it. Yes, he still calls witnesses to his covenant, but he calls witnesses of his own creation Specifically, the very first witness is possible. What is the first verse of the Bible? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. God calls his creation to witness against what his people are going to do. So yes, it is significant, but not because God is promoting polytheism. This statement takes us back to the very beginning when God created the very witnesses that he's calling to testify against his people. And in the end of verse 26, he said, "You will surely perish quickly from the land where you're going over the Jordan to possess it. You shall not live long on it, but you will utterly be destroyed." Verse 25 began with them living long on the land, enjoying the succeeding generations, and then verse 26 finishes with them being destroyed. And so we start with such high hopes, especially on the edge of the promised land right now, about to enter in. We would think that Moses is going to talk about all the opportunity and the hope and the prosperity, but he's actually continually reminding them to be guarded because there will come a time where they're going to depart from the Lord. And so that's why we see here that Yahweh is compassionate. And what I want to show you, we're going to see God's compassion clearly displayed, but I want you to see that it's displayed against the background of rebellion. These people are not a good people. These people are a people of rebellion. They rebelled with the golden calf. They will rebel throughout their history. So it is dark. This is the type of situation that surely needs compassion. But I want to tell you this. Unfortunately, Moses, as he preaches this sermon, is going to say that things are going to get better before they get worse. So as we read verses 27 and 28, we find this, that his compassion is displayed in the midst of judgment and bondage. Because verses 27 and 28 are actually going to take a step further. These previous verses, 25 and 26, say they rebel in the land, but now what we're going to find in these next two verses is they're going to actually be sent out of the land in judgment and be put into bondage. Read verses 27 and 28 with me. "The Lord will scatter you among the peoples, and you will be left few in number among the nations where the Lord drives you. There you will serve gods, the works of men's hands, wood and stone, which neither see nor hear nor eat nor smell." We see that God is going to bring judgment on this idolatrous people. And this judgment will culminate in exile, them being pushed out of the land and scattered in the midst of other nations. That's what verse 27 says. "He'll scatter you among the people." Now, I want to point out multiple times in this prophecy that as we work through the Old Testament, if you're attuned to some of these words, what you'll find is that the later prophets are going to come back to these passages and they're going to preach that these very things are happening to Israel. For instance, this word scatter. If you search for it in Jeremiah and Ezekiel, you will find these prophets preaching about this very thing, that God is going to scatter them. They are going to confirm these words of Moses and seek to exhort the future people of Israel in light of this truth, that if you don't wake up, you're going to experience this scattering. And then it says this, "You will be left few in number among the nations where the Lord drives you." Actually, one more thing about the scattering. Remember, their united life in the promised land is defined as their very life. So, to be scattered, to be disunified, to be out of the land, is like national death. Exile, being scattered among the nations, is no small matter. It actually is just like the promised death from the garden all over again, but this time on a national level. God said to Adam and Eve, "You eat and you will die." God says to the nation, "You worship idols and you will die." It's the same thing all over again. But then the rest of verse 27 says, "You will be left few in number among all the nations where the Lord drives you." Not only are they out of their land in the midst of the nations, but now they are reduced to few in relation to their previous numbers. And I think that this is so important for us to recognize when we view this in light of the whole story of Scripture. Why is that? Well, these are clearly judgments, but this is the exact opposite of a foundational promise that God made to the father of their faith. What did God say to Abraham when he called them out? Remember Genesis 12, we've talked about this often. It is one of the foundational passages in the Old Testament. God promises Abraham a seed, land, and he promises that he will be a blessing. And remember, when he promised Abraham a seed, he said it will be as numerous as a sand on the seashore. But now, they're as few. They're few. It is like a reversal of the Abrahamic covenant. Instead of innumerable descendants, their great numbers will be reduced to a few. Instead of the promised land in which to live and worship God, their wonderful land will be left behind for bondage. And instead of the blessed presence of God, their relationship with God will be defined by cursing and judgment instead of blessing and fellowship. It is like God is rewinding the clock. They're moving backwards instead of forwards. And unfortunately, this idea of broken fellowship with God is emphasized in the next verse. Look at verse 28. There, you will serve gods. No longer are they even serving the Lord. They departed from God in their own land, and now they're serving other gods in other lands. And look at these gods. They are gods that are the work of men's hands, wood and stone. They can't see or hear or eat or smell. Now, if you're familiar with the Old Testament, you realize that the rest of the Old Testament is going to pick up on this. And what's going to happen is the prophets of Israel in later days are going to come back, and they are almost to a level of mocking Israel because it is so, if I can use this word, stupid what they are doing. Let me give you an example of how the prophets pick up on Moses' language and they go to future Israel and they will say things like, look at what you're doing. Look at what you're doing. Idols formed by the hands of man are often the critique of Isaiah the prophet. Let me give you a few examples. Isaiah 2, verses 8 and 20 say, their land has been filled with their idols. They worship the work of their hands, that which their fingers have made. In that day, men will cast away to the moles and the bats their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship. What about Isaiah 31? In that day, every man will cast away his silver idols and gold idols, which your sinful hands have made for you as a sin. Especially once you get to Isaiah 40. I'm going to stop now because I could do this for a while. But Isaiah 40, Isaiah 44, Isaiah 45, Isaiah 46. It's like as Isaiah's prophecy goes on more and more, he says, this is stupid. Now actually, we find this in Jeremiah. Jeremiah actually uses that language. Jeremiah wants them to realize that these idols that their own hands have made cannot even do basic things of God's animate creation. Listen to this. Jeremiah 10, 14. Every man is stupid, devoid of knowledge. Every goldsmith is put to shame by his idols. For his molten images are deceitful, and there is no breath in them. They can't even take a breath. Or he says again in chapter 51, all mankind is stupid, devoid of knowledge. Every goldsmith is put to shame by his idols, for his molten images are deceitful, and there is no breath in them. At the beginning, at the end of his prophecy, he wants us to know that it is stupid to worship anything of our own creation. Now, let me just say this. How often do we do that? Now, for us, again, let's be clear. For us, the types of things that we're worshiping are our portfolios. Is it constantly growing? And yet, it's the type of thing that we always hear, can we take it with us when we die? Is it going to make an ultimate difference? We worship, at least in the Western world, a major thing is our pleasures. What do I want to do at this moment? We are crafting our own image. Literally, we do this online. We do this with our desires. Who do I want to be? And then we bow down and worship it. I think if Jeremiah and Isaiah were here today, to some of us, they may say, you are stupid. You are crafting your own life, and you are bowing down to it. So, as we look at this, we see that things are getting worse and worse. And as Moses preaches, by no means is he just setting up this wonderful life that's going to be lived in a land. Actually, he's setting up many consequences and many concerns. But let me just give you one more passage. If you want the quintessential passage to think about the just the insane nature of worshiping anything other than the one true God, Psalm 115 is the place to go. I'm going to read you a few verses. This is verses 4 to 8. Their idols are silver and gold, the works of men's hands. They have mouths, but they cannot speak. They have eyes, but they cannot see. They have ears, but they cannot hear. They have noses, but they cannot smell. They have hands, they cannot feel. They have feet, they cannot walk. They cannot make a sound with their throat. Now listen to this. Those who make them will become like them, everyone who trusts in them. So, they are lifeless, and you will be too, if you choose to walk that way. It sounds a lot like what Solomon says in Proverbs. There's a way that seems right to a man, but the ends of it are the ways of death. You form this thinking that this is what gives you life, and instead, it brings you to death. You become like them. You become just as lifeless as they are. So, in these verses, it's almost as if God is winding back the clock towards Abraham's day, and even possibly before that. Instead of increasing numbers, they decrease. Instead of remaining in the land, they're sent out. And instead of God's blessing, they experience God's cursing. This is the exact opposite of the Abrahamic covenant, people, land, and blessing. What a sad story is being painted here. We're being told such a really horrible story, right even before Israel steps foot into the land proper. But we need to read on, because this is where God's compassion is presented in such clarity. We see that it's displayed against the background of rebellion and in the midst of judgment and bondage. But as we get to these next verses, we see the wonderful thing that his compassion is displayed in his promised deliverance. That out there, he will act. Out there in the future, he is going to act and he is going to bring about deliverance for his people. Read verses 29 to 31 with me. But from there, you will seek the Lord your God. And you will find him if you search for him with all your heart and with all your soul. When you are in distress and all these things have come upon you, in the latter days you will return to the Lord your God and listen to his voice. For the Lord your God is a compassionate God. He will not fail you, nor destroy you, nor forget the covenant with your fathers which he swore to them. So there very clearly we see that Moses' main point, if we want to say it like that, is God's compassion. That's what he wants to talk about. But it took him a little while to get there because of the way that his compassion is going to be displayed. So he says, from there, in these other nations, when you experience God's cursing, you're going to seek the Lord your God, and you will find him if you search for him with all your heart and with all your soul. Their whole being will be involved in this search. They will pursue the Lord again wholeheartedly. After having divided and apostate hearts, there will be life. There will be renewal. And then verse 30 reminds us of just how bleak that picture was. They're in distress. All these things, and these things is referring to all these curses. When you are in distress because all these curses that I've promised have come upon you, in the latter days, Israel would return to the Lord and listen to him. This is great news after so much distressing news. But I do want to just point out that at least to this point, after reading verse 30, we might say this. Why have we titled this, God is Compassionate? Wouldn't it have better be titled, Israel Finally Makes a Right Decision? I mean, that's kind of what it seems like. You know, after all this time, I'm going to bring judgment upon you, and then finally, you're going to wholeheartedly seek me again. It seems like Israel is the initiator. They are the ones who seek and search for him with all their heart and soul. They're the ones who return to the Lord and listen to his voice. Yes, God is the one promising it. But it seems that Israel is the one that actually brings it about. How does that display God's compassion? Well, let's look at verse 31 because it begins with the word for and it does answer that question. It says, for the Lord your God is a compassionate God. It explicitly says that the reason, cause, or basis for Israel's return, for the people of God waking up and coming back to him, the reason for that is the fact that God is a compassionate God. He is compassionate, and so Israel will come back. Now, the rest of the verse fleshes this out even more. Look at that. He will not fail you, nor destroy you, nor forget the covenant with your fathers that he swore to them. The foundational reason that Israel will return is that God does not forget. Remember, all the while we've been reminded, Moses has been reminding us, don't forget, be guarded. And we come back and we realize God does not forget. God does guard his covenant. The reason that Israel will ultimately come back is because God is faithful and God is compassionate. God made a promise and he will fulfill it. He will not allow his word to fail. Therefore, in those latter days, Israel will return. So, God's compassion is displayed in his promised deliverance. Because though Israel will act by seeking him again, it is his promise and his faithfulness that ensure that response from Israel. I think this gets us to an issue we face really on every page of Scripture. Often it's presented as that question of divine sovereignty and human action or responsibility. But this tension of man's action and God's initiative, often it's stated as a problem that must be solved. But in reality, it really is a privilege that we celebrate. And what I mean by that is because the Almighty God, who is over all things and hold all things together, allows you and I to respond to him. Now, that does not mean that even our own responses are outside of his control. Actually, no. His compassion is the reason for anything that we do. But it is a response that's under his authority and directed by his will. And yet, it's also a choice that we make and are responsible for. It's a privilege to be celebrated. If we treat this truth as a problem to be solved, then we often end up discouraged because great minds, much greater than any of in this room, have wrestled with that and never truly been able to put it all together this side of eternity. Though we do have some answers, they are answers that don't fully compute to finite human beings. It reminds me of what Moses is going to come back to at the very end of this book, and he's going to say this: the secret things belong to God, but those that are revealed are for us and for our children forever, so that we might do the things that he's commanded. And here's the reality. This all does work out in the mind of God. He is over all things, and yet he has given things for us and for our children so that we might obey, and we're responsible. So, God is compassionate. This is the point that I wanted to spend most of our time with. But we need to move on to get to the second idea that's really taken up, which is really the reason for his compassion. He's covenant-keeping. God is a covenant-keeping God. That is what brings out this compassion. So we find this in verses 32 and following. Now, in this section, we have a bit of an interplay between the ideas of distinctiveness and faithfulness. Initially, we're introduced to Israel's distinctiveness, and that idea is going to point to God's faithfulness. Then we're going to be introduced to God's distinctiveness so that Israel would be faithful. Now, right now, that kind of sounds like a jumbled mess, but just stick with me, and I think it's going to make sense by the end. So I want to show you this, that the fact that God is a covenant-keeping God is shown by Israel's distinctiveness. Look at verses 32 to 36. Moses is going to preach for a little bit about how different Israel is than any other nation. He says in verse 32, "Indeed, ask now concerning the former days which were before you, since the day that God created man on the earth, and inquire from one end of the heavens to the other, has anything been done like this great thing? Or has anything been heard like it? Has any people heard the voice of God speaking from the midst of the fire as you have heard it and survived? Or has a God tried to take another nation for himself from within a nation by trials, signs, and wonders, and by war, and by a mighty hand, and outstretched arm, and by great terrors, as the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? To you it was shown, that you might know that the Lord, he is God. There is no other besides him. Out of the heavens he let you hear his voice to discipline you, and on earth he let you see his great fire, and you heard his words from the midst of the fire." Verse 32, Moses tells Israel to go back as far in history as possible, and as far as the east is to the west, and to discover if anyone has experienced what they have experienced. They are distinctive. They are different. Obviously, Moses is referring to Israel's distinctiveness, but what specifically is he talking about? We'll look down at verse 33. This answers our question. Moses is talking about what he's been talking about for the last chapter, the time where they were at Sinai and they heard God speak from the fire. And then verse 34 makes clear that he has even more in mind. He wants them to return to what he's been talking about, but he wants them to go even further back. Because in verse 34, he makes clear that he starts at Mount Sinai, but he goes backwards to the Exodus, the plagues leading toward their release from bondage in Egypt. Moses wants them to discover if any other God in all history, from the east to the west, has ever brought about a deliverance like Yahweh. And the implied answer is absolutely not. This has never happened. Nothing like this deliverance has ever been known. But why does he bring all this up? Clearly, he's trying to make it clear that Israel is distinctive and that God has done something unparalleled and distinctive with them. In short, God is doing all this so that Israel might know them, know him, giving them a privilege that no one else had. Look at verses 35 and 36. He says that he did this so that they might know the one true God God did all this to make clear to them that He is the only God. Yahweh is God alone. Israel was given the unique privilege of hearing God's voice, seeing His fire. They heard the very words of God from the midst of the fire at Sinai so that they might know there is no one like this. He is God alone. So what's the point? Israel is distinctive. They've experienced things no one else has. They've come to know the one true God in a way that no one else does. They are privileged and they are distinctive. So that is going to highlight the fact that God is covenant-keeping, because as we saw in verse 31, all of this comes because He made promises generations ago to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. He is covenant-keeping, and the fact that Israel has experienced things that no one else has shows that reality. But I also want to show us that God's faithfulness shows it. This is what I just said is where He goes next. He's going to go back in verse 37 and 38, two promises He made long ago. Look at verse 37. Because He loved your fathers, therefore He chose their descendants after them. And He personally brought you from Egypt by His great power, driving out before you nations greater and mightier than you, to bring you in and to give you their land for an inheritance as it is today. You see, this is where God's faithfulness is displayed. He made promises, and He's going to keep them, because He is a covenant-keeping God. That is who He is. That is part of His character. I want to show you a few things about God's faithfulness here. It's founded on His love. Look at that. Because He loved your fathers. God is faithful. And when we really get down to it, why does God make covenants? Why is God faithful to covenants? What, you know, all of this, we get down to this. He loves. He loves. Why did God create? Why does God love? Why does God enter into covenants? Because He loved. He loved your fathers. He made promises, and then He keeps them. He is a loving God, and that brings about His faithfulness. How then was this faithfulness expressed to them? Well, it's expressed by the fact that, look at the end of that verse, or in the middle of it. He chose their descendants after them. He loved these people, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and He then selects their people, their descendants. And then they experienced this in the deliverance of Egypt. He personally brought you out from Egypt by His great power. The end of verse 37 makes clear that God personally worked on their behalf in a mighty way so they might experience His faithfulness by means of a powerful, miraculous deliverance. But you know what? That actually wasn't even the end. They are redeemed from bondage, but it's ultimately for what we find in verse 38. It would culminate in an inheritance. He drives out nations before you so that you might have an inheritance as it is this day. Now, I went through that quickly, but I want to just really quickly step back for a second. Because all of those things that I just ran through about the way that God responded to His Old Testament people, Israel, are the same for us. It's how we experience His covenant faithfulness. Think about it like this. God's covenant faithfulness is founded on His love. If you ask this, well, why do we love Him? Why do we ever return to Him? Why do we ever come to Him? John says we love Him because He first loved us. His love is the foundation of His faithfulness and of His covenant keeping. This also is expressed by His choice of us, His people. It's interesting, Peter uses words very similar to this in 1 Peter 2, and he says, he takes words that are used of Israel and says something very similar to the people of God in the New Testament, the church. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. You were once not a people, but now you are the people of God. So we say God's covenant faithfulness is founded on His love, and it's expressed by a choice that we are a chosen people as well. And then we too, just like Israel, experience a deliverance. His deliverance is the way that we experience faithfulness. It's not the end of the story for us. You think about this. Israel experienced deliverance from the bondage of Israel, from Egypt, and we experience deliverance from the bondage of sin. So God, He loves us, He chooses us, He delivers us. And in the same way He gives an inheritance to Israel, He gives and promises an inheritance. There's a sense in which we've tasted that inheritance. As Hebrews says, we are striving to enter in the rest, and yet we've also experienced His goodness in Christ. And yet we too await. So I just want to point out that this faithfulness of God highlights how distinctive He is. And then all this about God's distinctiveness and faithfulness will bring about an exhortation. So we find in verse 39, he says, "Know therefore today and take it to your heart that the Lord, he is God in heaven above and on the earth below. There is no other." So now we get God's distinctiveness. We talked about Israel's. Now we see God's. How is God distinctive? Well, he's distinctive in the fact that he is in a category all his own. There is no one else. There is no other God. Remember last week we talked about how helpful our practice of capitalizing the G in God when referring to Yahweh and lowercasing a G when we talk about any other false gods, how helpful that is. And it shows that there is a distinctiveness in God's being. There's no one like him. He is the only God. Yahweh is distinctive because he alone carries the title of God. And that is why he is covenant keeping and all these other so-called deities are not. One more thing, and then we'll try to wrap it up here. This is where Moses is going with the whole sermon to this point. If God keeps his covenant, then Israel should too. Israel's faithfulness should be the result of all that they have seen. The fact that he's going to be compassionate in the face of their sin. The fact that he keeps his covenant over hundreds and even thousands of years. He says in verse 40, "So you shall keep his statutes and his commandments, which I am giving you today, that it may go well with you and your children after you, and that you may live long on the land which the Lord your God has given you for all time." All of this should bring them to obey God. He is good. He's been faithful to his covenant promises. He's delivered them. There's no other God. Therefore, they should and must listen to what he has said and is speaking through Moses. Not only should or must they do this, but the point of the end of the verse is that they get to do this. This is their life. To be able to live with this God in covenant fellowship and blessing is the whole purpose of their existence. It's why he's delivered them in the first place. So in these verses, we are reintroduced to Israel's distinctiveness. And we see that the reason that they're so distinctive is because God did this. He chose to. And this serves to show that God alone is God. And so Israel must continue in fellowship with him by upholding their end of the covenant. So church, you know, as we think about all of these things, the reality is the same is true for us. I'm not going to walk through that just because I want to finish. I want to finish here. So let's get back to our big idea. I want to park here as we finish. God demonstrates his exclusivity. He alone is God. We saw that last week. He is unique. We saw it this week. There are no idols. Israel, unfortunately, is going to turn to them, and yet God is going to be faithful in a way that is unimaginable, really. And that just shows that he alone is God and that he is different. And so in light of that, Moses wants to bring all of that to bear on the people of God and to say this, therefore, you must respond to this God with faithfulness. You must respond in obedience. And I think that it's really appropriate for us to really think about here as we wrap up for the spring. Because what is all of this to do for us? Well, remember where Israel is. They're right on the edge of the promised land. They're about to go in. There's a lot of hope. There's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of opportunity. That's what the future always, you know, this idea of what's out there, what could be. And it's so interesting. If we were in modern day America, probably what comes out at this point is not Moses, but a motivational speaker who says, "You be you, and you're going to live your best life now. Let's do it. Let's go in. You can do it." Moses comes out with the authority of God and says this, "Be guarded. Be guarded. You are going in to temptation, and you are going to fail. But God is compassionate. He's going to bring you back. In light of this great God, go out and obey everything I'm telling you to do." And so I think that that gives us some really helpful takeaways as we wrap up these four chapters. God demonstrates his exclusivity, so we must demonstrate our obedience. God will always be compassionate and covenant-keeping towards his sinful people, demonstrating that he alone is God. Therefore, we as his people must live a life of obedience. We must recognize the privilege and responsibility of relationship with him and obey. So, how can What can we take away from this passage in particular that helps us? Two things. If I'm going to give you two takeaways that you can take maybe over the next couple months, as we hopefully anticipate next fall as we go through the Ten Commandments, one each week, it's really exciting. I'm excited about it. But as we think about it, what can we take away? Well, two things. First, rejoice in his compassion, even in the face of your past, present, and future sin. Rejoice in his compassion. He is a compassionate God. He is faithful. He has made a covenant. He's not going to depart from you. If you are his child, what is Pastor been saying? Our Father who is in heaven. If you are his child, he is committed to you in covenant. He is not departing from you. He is compassionate, even in the face of your past, present, and future sin. And I think that's what's so amazing about this passage in particular. Moses is talking about things hundreds of years in the future, saying you're going to sin out there, and yet God is going to be faithful and you're going to come back. And so rejoice in his compassion, even in the face of your past, present, and future sin. But then, what that really should do in our hearts, it should not bring about what Paul is speaking about against in Romans 6:1. What do we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Wow, let's see lots more compassion. God is such a compassionate God. He's going to forgive my future sin. Let's sin up. You know, let's... No, Moses does not finish that way. He comes back and says, so, obey. So, listen. So, respond to his goodness with obedience. You see, it subverts that type of thinking that Paul is going against. Moses is going against. We respond to that great goodness with obedience. We let his compassion fuel our faithfulness. Even though if I go out and I sin tomorrow in this way, yes, he will forgive me. Well, then I don't want to do that. What a wonderful God who's forgiven me of all things. So what is he like? Well, let's look at our statutes and judgments. Now, again, obviously Deuteronomy is still the word of God, but some of our statutes and judgments are things like this, that sin should have no dominion over you, Paul says. What about this? This is your sanctification, that you abstain from fornication. Or 1 Corinthians 6, such were some of you. We take that list of things, covetousness, all these. All right, so we live in that way. We hear and see his compassion, and then we respond in obedience. Let's pray. Father, we do ask that as we wrap up this Deuteronomy series for this portion of the year, that you will help us to bring away from all of this what a great God you are.